Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a Courthouse Steps decision on Ames v. Ohio Department of Youth Services, featuring Nicholas Berry. Nick has been a senior litigation counsel at America First Legal since 2022. During that time, he has filed numerous lawsuits challenging lawless actions by governments and businesses. Before that, he litigated cases as an assistant attorney general for the Tennessee Attorney General's Office. A graduate of Vanderbilt Law School, he began his career clerking for Judge William Bertelsmann in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Kentucky. Our moderator today is William Trackman. Will is a general counsel for Mountain States Legal Foundation. Previously, he was appointed to serve in the Department of Education as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Office for Civil Rights. He's also chair of the Colorado Federalist Society, the vice chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights' Colorado Advisory Board, and an adjunct professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Will, thank you for joining us today. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Marco. Happy to be here, and happy to be here for a return appearance with my friend Nicholas Berry from America First to talk about Ames. And the decision that was issued yesterday, unanimous decision in favor of Ms. Ames and allowing her employment claim to go forward. Nick, why don't we start with maybe a little bit of a refresher on the facts and how we got to the place that we are now, which is a Supreme Court opinion.
Sure. So Ms. Ames was working for the state of Ohio. She was hired on as an executive secretary back in the early 2000s. She ended up getting promoted to an operations manager position, program administrator, I think was her title. And then she sought a promotion to a management role, which she was denied. She didn't get the promotion. But then they demoted her back to her executive secretary role. Then they hired a gay man for her old program administrator role, and she alleged that this all occurred because of discrimination based on sex. And so she filed suit, went to court, made it to, you know, summary judgment, Rule 56. And while there, the court applied the McDonnell-Douglas test, which is the three-part test. The first part being, can the plaintiff maintain a prima facie case? And they said no, because she failed to articulate background circumstances that would indicate this was the strange employer, the unique employer that discriminates against a majority individual. She appealed that to the Sixth Circuit, which affirmed based on its prior circuit court precedent. It had to affirm. Kethledge had a nice concurrence saying this probably violates the Equal Protection Clause, is ripe for reconsideration. Supreme Court accepted the writ of cert solely on the background circumstances test. And then we got 9-0 that actually you should read Title VII, and it says nothing about background circumstances. And so this is just made up and not enforceable, and remanded it back down.
Yeah, I think we had the intuition after oral argument that this was going to be a unanimous opinion, just based on the way that oral argument and some of the questioning went. Talk a little bit about the opinion, its author, and the reasoning, and whether you were surprised or basically this was what you expected.
Yeah, I wasn't surprised. It's basically what I expected. I figured it would be a comfortable, you know, 8-9 majority opinion. You know, they gave it to Justice Jackson, which is not surprising. You know, And the opinion is pretty bland overall. It really seeks to avoid any contentious topics and just says, look, there's a circuit split. This is background circumstances test exists, regardless of the state of Ohio's argument that it doesn't actually apply and it doesn't create an additional requirement. Clearly creates an additional requirement that's not found in Title VII. We can look at the language of Title VII. And because, you know, this isn't part of that language, it's not appropriate. And everybody gets a fair shake. It says, you know, that Title VII says any individual. That means each individual. There's no differentiation based on group. There's no differentiation based on majority or minority status. And so it means what it says. You know, vacated and remanded effectively. It's kind of, and I think that's what we talked about last time was kind of expected based on, you know, the briefing and the oral arguments is this is a pretty straightforward issue. So kind of
just in candor, I was a little disappointed that the opinion wasn't more sweeping. I mean, I'm not sure what I expected from a unanimous court that was going to give this to Justice Jackson. But it did seem like a very normal, read the statute again type opinion when really multiple circuits have been applying differential pleading standards depending on the race of the plaintiff, including where I sit right now, the 10th Circuit. This doctrine has been used for decades. It's been applied to deny Caucasian or white plaintiffs their day in court. And here we have a Supreme Court just saying, oh, this is incorrect, get it right next time without any real consequences for the courts that have been doing this wrong. I think the DC circuit started in the early 80s doing this. And we got kind of a milquetoast opinion. What was your take on that issue?
Yeah, I mean, I thought they could have done, there could have been more analysis of, to try to prevent this type of thing in the future or having it kind of snake back in, you know, Judge Kethledge in the Sixth Circuit pointed out that this, if it was taken up in the first instance as a statute, right? If this was statutory, if background circumstances was statutory language, the court would necessarily analyze it under strict scrutiny and find it wanting in a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. You know, it would have been nice to have at least a paragraph or two saying something like that. You know, if this were statutory language and it was found, it would come under a harsher standard and would still fail because, you know, who knows what else might happen there moving forward in this space and whatever kind of, as I think Thomas said, judicial lawmaking might occur. You know, they didn't really do anything to cabin in future judges from being, I don't know, you know, able to read Title VII maybe a different way. Yeah, maybe creativity in it, you know.
Yeah, maybe I buried the lead here because this wasn't actually a race case. This was a case about a heterosexual woman saying I suffer discrimination based on my sex because a lesbian woman and a gay man were given either a promotion or my old position based on their sexual orientation. And so the race aspect wasn't front and center, but it was in the backdrop of this because plenty of courts have said, if you're white, you're a majoritarian plaintiff. You come from a position of privilege or power, or if you're male, you're even though you're actually not a majority member, you're, you know, a member of the minority, you're still presumed to be privileged and powerful. And so why would an employer discriminate against you? Talk a little bit about Justice Thomas's concurrence responding to that logic, and then you know, I'll let you do a victory lap because I think your brief got cited at least once or twice in that concurrence.
Yeah, our brief did get cited twice in that concurrence, which was great. Before we get there, I think we can go back even a step and say, you know, if you want to take a really controversial position, you should say Ames's case should be dismissed because sexual orientation is not a protected category under Title VII. Sex is a protected category. They didn't discriminate against her based on her sex. They discriminated against her, as she alleges, based on her sexual orientation, which is nowhere found in Title VII. Further, Congress has tried to amend Title VII multiple times to add sexual orientation and gender identity protection into it and has been soundly rejected by Congress. So with that background, you know, there is an argument to say that this entire case, you know, under a statutory reading should be dismissed on that ground, that nothing to do with background circumstances. I think as most people know, right, the courts have read sex to be broad, a very broad term to include sex stereotypes. Part of sex stereotypes somehow includes sexual orientation in a way that I can't ever quite grasp. It's almost like trying to hold putty, you know, it just keeps oozing out. But apparently there's a sex stereotype there, and therefore sexual orientation is in fact protected under sex. And that's, you know, the current state of the law. But that wasn't, you know, an issue in this case as it came up. And so I'm not surprised they didn't discuss it, but definitely an argument that the state of Ohio, you know, might like to pursue as it goes back down. As for the concurrence, yeah, Justice Thomas decided, if you read it, it kind of made me laugh because he starts off with this kind of, I'd really like to consider McDonnell Douglas in the appropriate case because it has some flaws, but not really going to discuss it here. Then he goes back and starts, he goes back and starts talking about the case at hand here and cites our amicus brief for some of the propositions that, you know, the case contradicts reality. You know, the rule contradicts reality when it says, oh, this is an odd employer that's the majority that would do this kind of thing. Well, we all know that that's not true in today's day and age. And he cites some of the examples that we gave. But then he just turns his ire right back to McDonnell Douglas and goes after it again, which was pretty interesting.
Yeah. So there's this subcurrent at oral argument that really had nothing to do with Ms. Ames or the issue before the court about this burden shifting framework that comes out of a previous Supreme Court case called McDonnell Douglas, where the burden is on the plaintiff at the beginning to establish a prima facie case. And then the burden flips to the defendant to say, well, no, we fired this person for reasons that have nothing to do with their race, their sex, their religion. And then the burden flips back to the plaintiff to say, those reasons are all pretextual. And that doctrine runs throughout lower court employment law cases involving discrimination. And I thought Justice Thomas, I haven't gone through and verified this. It was interesting. He said, we've never actually said that McDonnell Douglas is a mandatory test in employment cases. I did not realize that was the case. I just assumed that these lower courts were following some implied directive from the court. What's interesting is that they had a different petition for certiorari that was pending at the time of oral argument called Hiddle, and that got denied. Since oral argument with Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch dissenting from denial, that would have teed up this very issue. But then Justice Thomas said, well, I would take that issue next time. It does seem like that kind of drove a little bit of the oral argument and maybe a little bit of the interest here in the concurrence.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the quote from the opinion here was, you know, the question is whether the defendant intentionally discriminated against the plaintiff, right? That's the Title VII ultimate question that they're trying to get at. And Justice Thomas's point is you can get there more than one way. McDonnell Douglas might be a way, but it's not the only way to prove that point. And I think the really interesting thing that he drew out here is that McDonnell Douglas was meant to be a bench trial standard. So you had a judge at a bench trial who's evaluating the evidence, trying to come to a conclusion. But that has been adopted and imported into a Rule 56 standard where you only have to raise a genuine dispute of material fact on one of your elements to survive summary judgment, right? That's what a plaintiff would tell you. The defense might say, no, it's the standard articulated in McDonnell Douglas. You have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence to survive summary judgment. And Justice Thomas says, no, that violates Rule 56, and Rule 56 carries the day here. The evaluation, even if you're going to use McDonnell Douglas as an evaluative tool at the summary judgment stage, you need to evaluate it with Rules 56's standards, which are genuine dispute of material fact. If that exists, it's a triable question of fact for the jury. There's no burden on the plaintiff at the summary judgment stage to prove by preponderance of the evidence that a fact exists. They don't need to do that to survive summary judgment. And if that's what courts are requiring, then they're messing the whole thing up. And he has a whole argument about why these judge-made rules create so many problems. And this is one of them, is because of the way it interacts with the other rules and it creates confusion. And one of the points that he did point out on the majority, I should say, on the confusion point is the background circumstances. How do you decide who's a majority? How do you decide who's not a majority? I think we talked about that a bit last time, that that's a really intractable question. But he expands that out into the McDonnell-Douglas test to say, there's lots of questions. What is proving by preponderance of the evidence that this, the justifiable reason was pretext? How do you do that at summary judgment? Isn't that something you're trying to prove to the jury? Because you're not, who cares if it's pretext? All you have to do is show that the defendant intentionally discriminated against you based on one of these protected characteristics. If you can do that, even if it wasn't the only reason, but it was a reason, that's sufficient to satisfy Title VII. And the burden that is being put up now is much, much more difficult than Title VII would require. Again, it's go back and read the statute. That this isn't required by the statute.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of the Muldrow case from a year or two ago, where there was an issue about how the plaintiff had to make some showing about an adverse action. And the court, in a 9-0 opinion, said that's not quite what the statute says. And honestly, I was worried that that was going to be the result here, as opposed to a broad sweeping opinion about how courts shouldn't use race or courts shouldn't use the sexuality of the plaintiffs in front of them to decide how they're going to adjudicate a case, because I think as America First Legal has pointed out in other contexts, there were some judges who announced practice standards saying, if you're a non-white lawyer, let me know and I'll go ahead and grant you a hearing in my court in order to, you know, create diversity in the ranks of attorneys before me in this court. And it just seems like this is an epidemic of the use of race, sex, other factors in order to make decisions in court. And that's not squarely addressed in this opinion. There is a little snippet from Justice Thomas's opinion about how DEI measures by employers are proliferating. And I thought that was at least effective. Do you see any other longer term impact of the case in future cases that might be brought?
Yeah, I mean, I think Justice Thomas has put out the siren's call to like conservative Title VII, you know, people who want litigators who want to weaponize Title VII against kind of these leftist DEI policies. Right. He's come out and said, look, it's a lot easier to maintain a Title VII claim than the case law would have you think. And the way that it's being applied is wrong. And so bring some cases so it can get to us and we can clarify the McDonnell-Douglas and the standard of, you know, having to prove by preponderance of the evidence that summary judgment is not appropriate. That's not the standard. That's not what you have to do. I would even say your regular employment litigators out there who are just plaintiff's attorneys doing regular plaintiff's work should be latching onto this and really pressing their district courts to say, look, all I have to do is raise a genuine issue of disputed material fact that these people, this defendant, considered, you know, race or sex or whatever the protected characteristic and the decision on my client. That's enough. That's all I have to do. And I can do that with direct evidence, circumstantial evidence. It doesn't matter. And we don't have to have these different evaluative models for, oh, well, if it's direct evidence, then we evaluate it this way, because then it creates kind of like, what's a majority? Who's a majority? How do you decide that? It's the same thing on direct evidence. Well, what exactly is direct evidence? What is exactly circumstantial evidence? I mean, we have some idea of it, but when you get into the middle, it can get hard to decide. And courts are trying to figure that out as they apply the McDonnell-Douglas test. And plaintiff attorneys now can come in and say, you don't have to do that, court. This is a much simpler process than we've previously suspected. So yeah, I think it will have some pretty big changes on how these cases get litigated, especially through summary judgment.
Just as a reminder to our audience, we do have a Q&A box at the bottom of your screen. We already have some questions stacking up. So if you've got one, go ahead and throw it in that Q&A box. I've got a few more, Nick, before we turn to.
Yeah, Q&A. Sure.
I think a lot of the press since yesterday has been about maybe this is a kill shot or perhaps at least a helpful tool against DEI in the workplace. Of course, it's a milquetoast 9-0 opinion. So, you know, as much as I would love for it personally to be a kill shot for DEI in the workplace, I'm skeptical that this is going to have that kind of impact. What do you think about the ability of an employee in the future to take Justice Jackson's majority opinion and say you have to end your DEI program or adjust your training or affinity groups or other things that may impact Caucasian employees or male employees or heterosexual employees as a result of the opinion?
Yeah, I don't think the opinion really touches on it, right? It's like you said, it's pretty narrowly tailored to the background circumstances question and doesn't expand on Title VII much beyond that. I think you can creatively take the opinion and apply it to some of those, especially to say, you know, this is indicia or evidence of discrimination, right? If you have affinity groups that only certain people can join, if you have trainings for people based on race, so only certain races can join a training, right? Those kind of things violate Title VII. And you don't have to prove background circumstances in these, you know, circuits anymore. But beyond that, the court has refocused the effort on the language of Title VII. So litigants can go back and point to it and say, look, the court has told us, read the statute. It means what it says. Any individual who suffers these things, I'm an individual, I'm suffering these things, this is what it is. And it's a new, it kind of opens up DEI as evidence of the discrimination, which, you know, may have been a little tougher road before. I think McDonnell Douglas will still get in the way. Because I think they're going to, you know, defendants and corporations will be able to point to business justifications for things that they're doing. And if you have to prove by preponderance the evidence of pretext, it's going to be tough. But I definitely think creatively you could use it, but it's definitely not a slam dunk DEI is dead kind of opinion at all.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's go to some of the questions from the audience. The first is from Sarah Reese asking, why is Justice Thomas so keen on eliminating McDonnell Douglas? Again, this wasn't the heart of the issue before the court. I had trouble tracing where this originated. I mean, he's got the dissent in Hiddle, and now this. Has this been a long-running target of Justice Thomas in terms of changing the way that we do this burden-shifting test?
I don't know if it's been a long running attack of his, but he clearly articulates why he wants to get rid of it now. And it goes back to what he thinks the problem is in the majority opinion of this case. And it's judge made rules overlaying statutory requirements that create confusion and problems in the judiciary. And so Title VII mentions nothing about background circumstances. But five circuits had decided that this was essential to a majority plaintiff's claim and that it was part of your prima facie case and that you had to meet this element or you couldn't proceed. And he said, look, this is judge lawmaking, and that's inappropriate. And he says, and while we're talking about judge lawmaking, let's look at this standard we've had for 40 years now called McDonnell Douglas, and let's look at all the confusion it's wrought across the judiciary and across litigants and litigation. Because again, he goes through part of the argument is, you know, part of the confusion it raises is what is direct evidence? What is circumstantial evidence? Look, as litigators, we all know you can prove your case with direct or circumstantial evidence, but it doesn't matter which you use, both are proof. Well, suddenly under McDonnell Douglas, whether your evidence is direct or not matters a lot, because direct evidence of discrimination does not go under McDonnell Douglas, right? And so now you have to try to take your evidence and say, no, this is direct evidence of discrimination. And the court says, but yeah, but is it? Maybe it is circumstantial. Maybe in a way, it, you know, and now it's trying to evaluate some question about the nature of your evidence before it even gets to the core of the issue. Beyond that, like we had previously talked about, the standard of proof you have to meet to get through summary judgment, the standard of proof you have to meet to get to a jury, all of that's bound up in McDonnell Douglas, and that's created confusion. And part of his point was, over the last, 40 years that McDonnell Douglas has been implemented, we still have confusion about how it functions, how it operates, how it should be implemented. If this was supposed to be a tool that helped trial judges at a bench trial resolve a Title VII claim, it's evolved so far beyond that and created so much confusion that's not getting resolved. We should get rid of it, right? It's not statutory and it's judge made. I think that's kind of his framework for it there.
Yeah. Next question is from anonymous questioner about your point on homosexual employees versus heterosexual employees and whether or not that is covered by Title VII at all. Do you view this as a negative because you have a unanimous court citing Bostock favorably for the point that only the written word is law and that Title VII is the text controls over judge-made law? I'll let you answer that, and then I have a follow-up question of my own. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think so. I've seen some stuff that's like, oh, the Supreme Court now has fully embraced sexual orientation as appropriate discrimination under Title VII, and the dissenters in Bostock have come. I don't think that is really what's occurred here. The question presented had nothing to do with that. And so the question before the court was, do majority plaintiffs have to have an additional level of proof they have to make over minority plaintiffs? And the court answered that question. Anything beyond that would be dicta. The fact that here below it was sexual orientation, that wasn't raised as an issue. And so it wasn't before the court to be decided. So I don't think it's been decided, if you will, in this case. I don't think this case decides it.
How gutsy would it have been for the lawyer for Ohio to come into court? Because I think we were both puzzled by his oral argument saying, well, you can affirm on other grounds, or this is just sort of a different way of saying McDonnell Douglas, that didn't really ring true to us and obviously wasn't the question before the court. But if the briefing had been all about how Bostock ought to be overturned, is that on a scale of 1 to 10, how gutsy of a strategic decision would that have been?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an appellate lawyer. I think there probably would have been some problems with having raised that argument below, and having, had it been in the writ and everything else, the court may have just rejected it outright and said, that's not before us, and wouldn't even have analyzed it. I think that's the likely outcome that would have happened. But that doesn't mean when it goes back, I mean, look, it was vacated and remanded. So presumptively, the state of Ohio, if it wants to go make those arguments now, can go make those arguments and say, look, this case should be dismissed because this isn't the court told us. Look, and in the Supreme Court opinion, it said, go read Title VII. So we went and read it, and it says sex discrimination, and we didn't discriminate against her on the basis of her sex. And so this case, she doesn't even allege we discriminated against her on the basis of her sex. I mean, that fails at the, at the pleading level. We let's get a judgment on the pleadings here. I'm sure they filed an answer already. So, let's do that. It's available. I think they should, seriously look at it.
What's interesting is I don't even read Bostock to say that all sexual orientations are covered. I think homosexuality is the one they address. And Bostock, I guess the implication is the reverse is true too, heterosexuality. But Bostock doesn't say anything about someone who's asexual or bisexual. And the logic in Bostock is, what if you flipped the sex and the employer would make a different decision? But that doesn't always work for every sexual orientation. So even on its own terms, it's hard to read Bostock so broadly. Okay. Next question is from Sean Callahan. As a general matter, does the Rule 56 standard for summary judgment makes sense with any burden shifting framework ever, where a defendant has to show anything in order to win?
In some way, right? If there's not a genuine dispute of material fact over the legitimacy of the termination reason, right, then there'd be no reason to get to pretext. So if the evidence came out and for whatever reason they couldn't put forward with no dispute of fact a legitimate reason for the termination, then I think the burden shifting framework in Rule 56 would meld there, and it would impact the analysis. So I could see it mattering at times, but it would probably be a pretty rare case where it mattered. But I hadn't, yeah. I haven't thought about that too much in other burden shifting contexts outside of this one. I'd have to think about that.
What do you think? Next question is from.
Do you have a thought on that, Will? Or am I?
Well, so in those contexts, really what the defendant is doing is saying, I have a complete defense, right? Not that I've carried a burden as part of a burden shifting framework, but there is nothing to the plaintiff's claim and they have failed to carry their burden. So I don't actually have a thought either on whether you could ever have a place where a defendant has a burden to disprove something as part of a summary judgment standard. It's possible there isn't one, right? I mean, we're just sort of spitballing right here, but if anyone in the audience has a thought on where it might be possible, let us know. Next question is from Stephen Kleinschmidt. How much will Ames influence the interpretation of other Civil Rights Act clauses? Title VI here is mentioned. Is there a chance that judges will take this decision and apply it to other contexts? The thing is, the background circumstances test has not been, as far as I've seen, a part of Title VI cases, say in, you know, a context where a student is Caucasian. I haven't seen this emerge in the same way as we have in Title VII, although I could be wrong. I don't know that it hasn't ever, but it is interesting. I do think courts will be chastened by the idea that background circumstances would ever be relevant again. Is that right?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, they made it pretty clear here that it doesn't count. You can't consider it. I don't know, because the opinion was so narrow, I don't know that it'll stretch across other civil rights statutes. Yeah, the unique nature of it, I just don't see how it's really all that applicable.
It was interesting in Justice Thomas's concurrence how unworkable the background circumstances test is. What do you do for Christians or Catholics? Do you count them as one monolithic religion, or do you subdivide them? And what about debates over whether certain denominations are themselves part of that religion? I thought that was an intriguing thing that I hadn't even thought of, really.
Yeah, and that was one of the points we kind of made in our amicus brief, was how do you decide majority for all of these different things? And then at what level do you do it? Is it, you know, is it just Catholics in Maryland? Is it Catholics in the United States? Is it just Catholics in Detroit? Is it just, you know, is it just blacks in Detroit? I think Justice Thomas points out, you know, Detroit is majority black. So then are whites a minority filing suit in Detroit? Or do we look at the state of Michigan? Or, you know, do we look at the region? Like, how do we even calculate that? So, yeah, I agree with you there. It's unworkable. It's an unworkable standard.
Yeah. We have a question from John Scheller, who this is basically the summation of, I think, Ohio's argument in their briefing. Why isn't the background circumstances test just another way of saying Twombly or Iqbal's plausibility standard is a little bit higher when you've got a white guy or some other member of a majority class? Why would that person suffer discrimination, especially if, you know, 60 or 70% of the population in the United States is Caucasian? Don't you need a little bit extra to rise to the level of Rule 8's pleading standard? I mean, that, to be clear, that is Ohio's argument in the briefing. So do you want to address that and maybe talk through why the court rejected that idea?
Yeah, I mean, it creates a different standard to maintain a claim based on your race or sex. And also, I think, as Justice Thomas in his concurrence points out, it's not reality anymore. It assumes. So the idea that it's not plausible to believe that a white employer would deny employment to other whites, well, that assumes that the white employer would be unlikely to take that step. And so you have a little higher requirement to get over whether the discrimination was plausible. But that doesn't accord with reality. White employers are consistently applying that standard in major corporations across the country to meet DEI quotas and targets. You know, if you listen to, you know, like I think Veritas folks came out with a video of some, you know, CEO talking about internal quotas and how they're going to meet them, and how executives are going to be punished and bonuses or terminated if they don't meet their quotas. Maybe they said, you know, Asians don't count for our minority count because we have too many Asians, right? Like, so if you're Asian at a company that has a bunch of Asian employers and you say you discriminated against for a promotion, and they say, oh, but the whole hiring staff was Asian, so you have to have a higher burden. I mean, that's just racism in a different way. That's just a, and so I think that's why the court rejected it. It doesn't, one, Title VII doesn't talk about this. It's any individual is entitled to the protection with the same standard. There's no separate standard. And if we're going to try to frame it into plausibility, it's virtually impossible to understand what you're even doing. So, and that goes back again to the majority minority point. The whole premise was that it would be an odd employer that discriminates against a majority. Okay, well, that has some implications. Who is the majority? How do you determine that? And is it true that the odd employer would do that? And I think all of those things have been found wanting. You can't determine who the majority is clearly. It's not the odd employer anymore that's engaged in this activity. And so the whole thing crumbles at that point, not to mention the fact it has no statutory basis in Title VII. So...
we've got a comment here, Braden Busek, who gives me a chance to plug one of Mountain State's cases, Young versus Department of Corrections. So just as an example of what you were talking about, we've got a Caucasian governor here, a Caucasian attorney general, and we've got a prison system that does very aggressive DEI training in Colorado that informs all corrections officers that they are white supremacists and that they think of African-Americans using the full N-word in the training. And that case has been dismissed the first time around. The attorney general argued background circumstances, saying even at the pleading stage, the background circumstances applies to a hostile work environment case that's brought by a Caucasian employee. Any thoughts on my case? No, I'm just kidding. Any thoughts on general applicability of Ames, at least as an atmospheric site in cases where the claim is about a hostile work environment brought by a Caucasian or male or heterosexual employee?
Yeah, I think the idea is that you get the same standard, you get the same analysis, right? You know, if we're going to compare it to Bostock, it doesn't matter, at least here, it doesn't matter if it's a white person bringing a hostile work environment claim or a black person. They both get the same standard, evaluative standard. So yeah, I think this would support y'all.
Thank you.
Clearly.
Very good. I mean, appreciate the plug.
Yeah. Brayden knows how to make people happy. That's
any concluding thought. That's all the questions we have. Any concluding thoughts on the opinion or what else we might see in the future about McDonnell Douglas or the background circumstances test?
Yeah, I think McDonnell Douglas is in the crosshairs, right? I think it's in the crosshairs now, and Justice Thomas has put the call out to the employment plaintiffs bar saying, you know, come challenge this. Title VII another way to read it is Title VII claims have become too hard to prove. And so we need to fix the current case law on it to go back to what Title VII actually says and what the actual requirement is. And it's that your immutable characteristic, that's a protected characteristic under Title VII, that was a basis for the adverse action that was taken against you. If you can prove that, you're satisfying your case. Yeah. And if you have evidence of that, then you should get to take it to trial and prove your facts up and get your case resolved that way. Not at a pleading standard, not at summary judgment where you have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. That's not what's required. And so, you know, the call's been put out and I'm sure he's going to get a lot of answers. So
very good. Well, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much, Nick. A great conversation. And thank you to all of our audience members who contributed questions. Very insightful and appreciated. And with that, I will turn it back over to Marco to close us out.
Well, thank you both for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.